Okay, confession time, folks. I am a nutrition coach who preaches to all of my clients the importance of eating their veggies. But you know what? I am not a big vegetable fan myself. I just don't really like them. I never have. I was forced to eat them as a kid, and now it's one of the areas that I really struggle with in my own healthy aging journey. So it's no surprise, really, that I'm more than just a little carnivore curious. In fact, I've wanted to interview an expert on the carnivore diet for some time now. And for those of you who might not be familiar, the carnivore diet is exactly what it sounds like. It's a diet where the only thing on the menu is meat. Stay tuned as we uncover the truths, myths, and the amazing health transformations behind this fascinating way of eating with a very special guest who has not only lived this lifestyle, but is leading the charge in a food revolution. Hello and welcome to the Over 50 Health and Wellness Show. I'm your host, Kevin English. I'm the founder of The Silver Edge, and our mission is to help you build and maintain a lean, healthy body that you love for the rest of your life so that you can show up in the second half of your life as the healthiest, strongest, most vital version of yourself. We have a great show for you today. Dr. Sean Baker is here, and he's going to share his thoughts and experience of living the carnivore lifestyle. If you are at all carnivore curious, stick around. This was a fascinating conversation. Today's podcast is brought to you by Legion Athletics. Legion makes supplements with all of the good stuff, like all natural ingredients and clinically effective doses, without any of the gimmicks like proprietary blends or hype. Now, look, here's the deal. You do not need supplements to build muscle, lose fat, or get healthy, but the right ones can definitely help. I personally love Legion's whey protein as well as their pre-workout. That pre-workout's called Pulse. And you folks can learn more by heading over to SilverEdgePartners.com and just click on the Legion icon there. And if you decide to order anything, please use coupon code SILVEREDGE at checkout. That'll save you 20% off your first order or double loyalty points on future orders. Again, that's SilverEdgePartners.com and be sure to use coupon code SILVEREDGE. My guest today is Dr. Sean Baker. Sean is a leading figure in the world of health, fitness, and nutritional science. He's a former orthopedic surgeon, and he has turned his decades of medical experience and athletic prowess into helping pioneer the carnivore diet movement, an approach that has revolutionized the way we think about food, health, and longevity. At 57 years of age, Sean is no stranger to pushing the limits of human performance. From setting world records in rowing to dominating in powerlifting in the Highland Games, his achievements in the athletic world are as impressive as his medical credentials. Sean's journey into carnivore diet was born out of a personal quest to optimize his own health and athletic performance, leading to remarkable personal transformations and a passion to share his discoveries with the world. He's the author of The Carnivore Diet. He's the founder of Rivero, a new medical platform dedicated to helping individuals achieve their health and fitness goals through optimal nutrition. Without further ado, let's meet Sean.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really excited to jump into this conversation today. I want to pick your brain on all things carnivore, of course. But let's back up a little bit and let's learn a little bit about you. Before we start, Sean, how old are you?
I'm 57.
57. All right. So we're about the same age. You're a few years younger than me. We grew up in the 70s. What did you eat as a kid when you grew up?
I remember eating cereal.
Cereal? Yeah. All right. Was it like
cereal, peanut butter sandwiches?
And, yeah.
Peanut butter jelly sandwiches. Captain Crunch and all that
Captain
stuff.
Captain Crunch.
And,
all the good ones. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, gosh, when I was a kid, I ate a lot of yogurt. I remember I used to eat these Yoplait yogurts by a lot. My mom was not a particularly good cook, unfortunately. I'm a big guy that likes to eat, and she was a very small woman that didn't think food was that important. So, you know, I mean, I ate, you know, my share of potato chips and junk food and Coca-Colas and hamburger and French fries and that stuff. You know, I think, I imagine I ate some fruits and vegetables, but probably begrudgingly so, particularly the vegetables, as I recall.
Yeah, right. But
Yeah, I mean, I probably would most, you know, TV dinners, that type of stuff, you know, the Swanson TV dinners and yeah, so that kind of stuff.
So I guess, and we could say back in the 70s, I mean, that sounds a lot like what I ended up eating. Now, I did grow up on a farm, and during that time, I was eating, you know, we had a beef cattle farm, we had our own chickens, eggs, vegetable garden. But once we moved away from there, I ate exactly what you're describing, right? A lot of sandwiches, macaroni and cheese, sugary cereals, all that stuff. Is it fair to say that back in that day, that was the standard American diet? Is that what most people were eating, do you suppose, in the 70s?
Well, I mean, there's no way for me to know what everybody was eating, but I'd say that was not uncommon. You know, I think everybody who went to school with their little lunchbox had a very similar, you know, sandwich, maybe a piece of fruit, maybe a cookie or something like that, you know, some milk or something. But yeah, I mean, I think that was what a lot of people were eating for sure.
Right on. And now, were you an active kid? I mean, you're a pretty big, strong, athletic guy.
I was active. I mean, I think from the age of, I was inspired by when Bruce Jenner won the Olympic decathlon back in, I think, 76, I would have been about, you know, 9 years of age. I remember that, and it inspired me to have like the neighborhood Olympics, which, you know, I got all rounded up all the kids and we did. And I've always been interested in athletics, you know, ever since that time, even, you know, now 50 years later, I'm still competing.
Still competing. Yeah. So, well, let's spend a minute here because you've done some pretty incredible things here. I love the fact that you got inspired to start the neighborhood Olympics there, and locally you're putting that together. But you went on, I mean, you held some powerlifting records. I believe you were a Highland Games Master Champion. Talk to us a little bit about some of your strength training. When did you realize that you were big, strong, and capable, kind of had a gift athletically for these sorts of things?
Well, I started lifting weights, I think, when I was about 13, you know, as a, you know, young high school kid, you know, or just going into high school. And I think I trained pretty regularly throughout high school. And I think by the time I was a freshman in college, I tried a deadlift for the first time. The first time I tried it, I lifted 455 pounds, which is,
come on, man. Let's you glossed over that really, really fast. The first time you tried to deadlift, and this is what, a freshman in high school? Did you say 455 pounds?
Yeah, I was 19. I remember I had a bet with a guy that I used to work with. You know, this guy named Jerry. I worked loading trucks at UPS in the morning before I'd go to college. And I was working out with him, and we were at the gym and kind of bet him. We were playing with it. And I said, if I can do that, you have to load my trucks tomorrow, right? Because he was my supervisor. And I did it. And he never has paid up on the bet, unfortunately.
He didn't keep his end of the bargain. Sorry, I interrupted you there, but I just didn't want to just gloss over, hey, the first time I tried to deadlift, I deadlifted 450 pounds. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, I went on to, I mean, over the years I trained, and I ended up, I think when I was about, took me another 10 years of training, but I finally got to about a 772 pound deadlift, I think as a 33-year-old medical student. I remember that. And I've done it always, you know, I'm wearing a shirt. I've had this shirt since 1996. It's kind of fun. It just says the strong will survive and they'll be drug free. I've never taken drugs. I've never been into drugs, and I've always been a lifetime drug free athlete. So I've been very proud of that. But yeah, I mean, I set a bunch of records in powerlifting, particularly deadlifting, several, you know, state, national, and a world record in the deadlift. I went on to do some strongman competitions, you know, where you pull the trucks and do the Atlas stones. I did that in my 30s, and I ended up at the first ever national championships. I took fifth, which is not bad. I mean, but I realized that there's a lot of drug use in that sport, and I decided that's not where I'm going to be able to be very successful. From there, I went into, the Highland Games. So now I'm in my early 40s. It's a Scottish thing. You put on a kilt. You throw big cabers, you know, like caber, telephone poles.
Tell people what a caber is.
It's a big pole. It's anywhere between 16 and 22 feet long, and you just run with it in your hands, and you try to flip it, and it takes an incredible amount of strength, timing, explosiveness to be able to do that correctly. And, you know, there was 9 events. You shot put a couple stones. You throw some weight, you know, like 56-pound weights with one arm and various ways, and throwing hammers and things like that. So I won the world championship in that as a master's athlete. And then I got into competitive rowing, interestingly, as I decided, you know, back in those days, I weighed, you know, close to 300 pounds, this big guy. And because you needed to be. I mean, you know, like, and I was a small guy on the field. I mean, even though I was 6'5", close to 300, a lot of the competitors were 6'8", 360. So, I mean, you think about, you know, that requires just a tremendous amount of strength and weight to counterbalance those implements. And then, at a point, I decided, well, you know, I don't want to be this heavy anymore. So I slimmed down and then I got into rowing and then I ended up breaking, gosh, how many world records have I gotten that now? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 world records, I think, 4 or 5 world records in rowing. And so that's, you know, indoor rowing. So on a concept too, which is what people in CrossFit use and the Olympic rowers train on, and they have competitions. They've been having competitions, gosh, since the 1970s on this thing. So yeah, that's kind of a synopsis of my sort of athletic escapades, I suppose.
Yeah, those are some impressive escapades there. Now, Sean, how were you fueling all of this? I'm going to guess you were not carnivore back in your 30s, maybe 40s.
Or yeah, I mean, I had a mixed diet. I ate just a lot of food. Gosh, I just ate yeah. a lot
well,
of food.
If you're 6'5", 300 pounds, yeah, got to fuel.
Yeah, I mean,
all
I was eating. I was usually. I mean, I would. It would be not unusual for me to eat in excess 7,000-8,000 calories a day. I mean, that was pretty typical. You know, I didn't go carnivore until I turned 49, you know, so I'm 57 now, so just about 8 years ago. So that was when that shift was made. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, people will look at me and say, wow, you're doing carnivore, you're in good shape. And you know, but I mean, to be fair, I've trained my whole life. And I think that's an important, very important variable that you train consistently over a long period of time. And the diet does have impacts, and I think it's been beneficial to me in retrospect, having looked at how I felt back then versus how I do feel and perform now. But yeah, that's my sort of fueling strategy, I suppose.
All right, so I know in your book you talk about during this time when you were really big, really strong. Like you said, you're smashing 6,000-7,000 calories a day, which is that's a lot of food, folks. You talk about developing metabolic syndrome. And you talk about while you're by the measures of strength, you're very healthy. If we're just going to measure absolute strength, you're one of the strongest people on earth and you're setting these records. But then you say, hey, turns out my metabolism maybe not so healthy. What was going on there and what did you do to change that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think about 42, 43 years of age, I just, you know, started to realize I wasn't sleeping well. My blood pressure was creeping up a little bit. I was probably developing sleep apnea, to be honest, you know. And I, you know, this is about the time and the point I was like, you know, I don't really have the interest into being super big and strong. And, you know, I mean, I was training very hard. I could run sprints. I could dunk a basketball when I was 285 pounds pretty easily. I mean, I was still very strong and explosive. Even in my 40s, I was dunking basketball. In fact, last time I dunked a basketball, I was 51. So haven't tried in a few years. Maybe I can do that again. But I said, well, I can't do anything more on the physical side. I can't work out any harder. So I need to start playing with diet. And so I just went into this, you know, I'm eating 7,000-8,000 calories a day. Well, let's just cut back on that. So I did. I just ate less. I ate, you know, a relatively lower fat diet, high in, you know, vegetables and fruits and lean proteins. And I lost weight. I mean, it worked for sure. However, I mean, I went from like 285 down to about 235 in a course of about 3 months. I dropped about 50 pounds in 3 months. I was working out 3 times a day. I mean, I get up early, early in the morning before I went to work to do surgery. I would do jump rope, a couple thousand jump ropes. And then I would, on my clinic days, I'd do a lunchtime workout. And then I get home, I put my kids to sleep, and I go and do another couple thousand jump ropes. So that clearly wasn't sustainable for me. And I was in a huge caloric deficit. So it did work to lose the weight, but it wasn't sustainable. And I was pretty miserable. I mean, I was hungry all the time. I was grouchy. So that was something that didn't really work well for me. So then I had I evolved the diet, eventually ending up in a more low-carb diet, a ketogenic diet. And then, you know, after seeing these wacko, crazy people eating nothing but meat, thinking they were nuts, like yeah. everybody does, I tried it. And, you know, I mean, gosh, I'm still shocked at how good I felt, you know, relative to even already being on a low carb diet. I mean, and that had benefits for sure. I just felt a greater, profound sense of satiety and less hunger, you know, so I didn't need to eat so much. And that was great. But, you know, when I went from a ketogenic diet to a carnivore diet, I got, you know, even a, more of a benefit from that. And that was really kind of a quote unquote game changer for me personally. Athletic performance got better, by the way. I mean, by about 2-3 months in, I was getting stronger and leaner and faster and more powerful, going from low carb to carnivore, which was interesting. It might have been just a greater amount of bioavailable protein that I was now consuming versus, you know, previous to that.
Okay. So lots of things I want to pick apart in there. One, that weight loss is pretty dramatic, right? I mean, you were a big dude, so you know, percentage wise, that's still pretty dramatic. 50 pounds in 3 months. You mentioned you did that primarily, it sounds like, through what the common weight loss advice is, right? Eat less and exercise more or move more. Mm-hmm. So you're doing this intense cardio. You mentioned 1,000 skips at a time, and you're in this calorie deficit. Do you feel like you were losing muscle as well as fat during that time? Were you doing any kind of body composition testing, body fat testing? Do you have a sense for how where that weight was coming from? Was it primarily fat? Was it fat and muscle?
I think it was primarily fat. I mean, I was training hard the whole time. So I was doing what I think anybody that's losing weight, regardless of the method, whether it's caloric reduction or some of these new drugs, I think the strength training is critically important to maintain. I mean, clearly I would have lost some muscle because I got a little bit weaker, not that much, but I definitely lost a little bit of strength, but I was pretty jacked. I mean, I was lean. I was pretty muscular, you know, and looked the best I'd looked in, you know, probably my whole life, quite honestly, up to that point. But, you know, like I said, it was just not something that was particularly something I think I could sustain over the long term, you know?
Sure.
And so,
yeah,
but, you know, and, you know, my mood was not good. I was tired. I was hungry. The nurses at the hospital said, "Hey, we like the kind of the fat Dr. Baker yeah. help a lot better because you're kind of a,
we like the fat Dr. Sean better. Yeah, huh?
You're kind of an ass right now." So anyway.
Sure. Okay. No, I think a lot of people can relate to that. All right. So we have this progression then. You've gone from this full on beast mode, eating just everything, sounds like. And then as you're losing weight, you're doing that through calorie reduction. And it sounds like the progression then is this calorie reduction, this low carb playing around with that led then to keto, that led to carnivore. Is that kind of the natural progression for you?
Yeah. And I think that's a pretty typical progression for a lot of people. Okay. They kind of fall into that low carb rabbit hole, and then they start seeing all the people doing carnivore, and they think, "Is it, you know, could it be better?" And for a lot of people, it is.
All right, so this would have been, I mean, right? Carnivore's having a moment here. It's not quite as fringe as it would have been. What are we talking, 7-8 years ago when you would have started this?
Yeah, I started in 2016, and so I went on Rogan 2017, which that's when it kind of got a little bit more sort of. Yep. Notoriety, I suppose. And yeah, it was definitely considered fringe. It's still considered, you know,
pretty fringe,
I suppose, but it's less so. I think a lot of people have heard of it now, and they have their opinions on that. Some, you know, think it's the worst thing ever, and other people think it's the best thing ever. So it's
pretty
really
polarizing. Yeah. What we eat in general is pretty polarizing, and we're going to pick that apart as well. But all right. So 2016, you go carnivore. And for folks who don't know, you were on the podcast show. You were just recently back on Rogan's show, right? Weren't you just?
Yeah, I was on back in November of December.
Okay. So, December. Yeah, ago, so yeah. Just recently. So a couple times. So Joe picks you up, and that obviously is going to help bring this to millions of people, right? That awareness. So today we have people like you and Paul Saladino. We got a lot of people that we can go to and get some carnivore information from. Where did you get carnivore information from? Or how did you first hear about this? Who were you taking advice
from? Yeah. So there was a Facebook group called Zeroing In on Health. It was run by a guy named Charles Washington. He's a guy from, I think, Philadelphia or somewhere. He might be somewhere in Pennsylvania. And there were people that have been doing this diet for, there's a couple, Charlene Anderson had been supposedly doing the diet for 20 plus years. And, you know, so there's a correct collection of online of it was maybe a couple thousand people that have been doing this. And somehow, I don't know how I stumbled across it. I can't remember now, but I just kind of, with sort of morbid curiosity, kind of was reading all the stuff they've been writing. And I thought initially, this is pretty damn nutty. But then I kept seeing like objective evidence of people clearly physical transformations and lab work and, you know, lab results and things like that. I said, well, this is kind of interesting. Let me try it. And so I tried it, and basically what they were saying turned out to be accurate, at least in my case. And so I thought that was quite interesting.
Okay. And so for folks that don't know, I'm getting ready to ask you a whole bunch of the questions that you answer every single day about carnivore, right? We're going to talk about what about cholesterol? What about fiber? What about vitamins? We're going to get there in a minute. But before we go there, because you just mentioned that people are having these amazing health transformations, and clearly they are on this carnivore diet. Can you talk a little bit about some of the health transformations that people are seeing? What sorts of health issues does carnivore seem to help with?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it can be helpful for a whole host of chronic conditions. I think just about every chronic disease you can think of, I've seen some people benefit significantly from that. I think it's particularly useful for, obviously, metabolic disorders, obesity, diabetes, prediabetes, hypertension, metabolic syndrome. It's also quite helpful for autoimmune disease, which is kind of interesting. You know, when you talk things like psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, tremendously effective at inflammatory bowel diseases, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. I mean, we've seen people with mental health disorders, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, PTSD even, see significant benefit from this. So I think it's you know, I think good nutrition across the board helps chronic disease. And I think this is, in my view, it's very good nutrition. I've seen people, I mean, I've got food addiction is another great one. You know, I mean, had a gal, 800-pound woman, has lost darn near 500 pounds on a carnivore diet. First time in her life, she says she's found this sort of off switch, finally, that drove these compulsions away. You know, she had tried, you know, vegan diets, juice fasting, Mediterranean diet, you know, protein shakes, bariatric procedures, nothing worked for her until she went carnivore. So it has a whole bunch of, I mean, I saw a gal with Tourette's syndrome, which is this weird neurologic condition, makes you have these weird vocalizations and facial tics. That went away on carnivore. I mean, God, I saw a woman with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is and several of those, in fact, it is a connective tissue disorder of the collagen, which you're born with, but it's actually improved to where the point where this lady was, she was a physician herself, 57-year-old physician, waking up every single day with joints dislocated from sleeping. When she'd sleep, her ankle would pop out of joint, her shoulder would pop out of joint, her wrist would, so she'd have to start her day putting her joints back in place, and she would go to work at the emergency room, and half the time on her shifts, one of her joints would pop out of place. And this has been going on for years and years. She went carnivore. Within 1 month, she stopped having dislocations and was able to go back to the gym. And I think it's been, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now, and she's not had any dislocations since then. So really, really interesting stuff for sure.
It is really interesting. And I'll say this, just from the outside looking in, it seems to me that carnivore would be extremely nutty and out there if it weren't for all of these amazing health transformations. So let me ask this. Do you think that it's possible that people are getting these amazing health transformations because of what they're not eating as opposed to what they are eating? So in other words, is the magic in here, and this is probably a more nuanced conversation than yes or no, but is the magic in here the fact that they're getting just this amazing nutrient-dense food source, and that's what's helping them heal? Or is it because these people are coming from standard American diet? Now, all of a sudden, when we go carnivore, we're not eating gluten, we're not eating soy, we're not having preservatives, sugar, additives, all of these other things. Do you think, in other words, is it because of what I'm eliminating? Because this is the ultimate elimination diet, right? Or is there something specific about high quality meats that are producing these kind of, let's face it, these are miraculous type transformations people are having on carnivore diets?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, quite honestly. I mean, clearly, I think, you know, I mean, we just got to report how much plastic people are accumulating in their body. I mean, our food system is killing us, literally. It's literally, I think we're slowly poisoning ourselves with the majority of the food that we consume these days. So clearly, eliminating that stuff has tremendous benefits. And you can see, that's why a lot of diets, whether it's a whole food plant-based diet or a carnivore diet, seems to be efficacious, removing that stuff. Now, beyond that, I do see a lot of people that are coming from a relatively clean diet. It might have been a vegan diet. It might have been a Mediterranean diet where they don't eat the junk food. And sometimes, you know, removing the fruits and vegetables for, you know, has been helpful for people. So, I mean, clearly there's something uniquely powerful there. I mean, I think when we're looking at healing the body, rebuilding the body, turning over cells, I mean, having high quality nutrients is extremely healthy. I mean, we are undeniably all made out of the same thing, animal cells at the cellular level. And we're not made out of, we don't have cell walls, we're not plants. The nutrients that make up animal cells are pretty consistent across species for the most part. And those are the nutrients you need. I mean, you think about it. If I'm building a brick house, I'd like to have some bricks rather than straw and mud because it's going to be much less efficient to do it that way. So I think it accelerates the repair and the healing process. At the same time, it eliminates the garbage that we're consuming. So I think it's both.
All right. Yeah. No, I think that's fascinating. And there is a, I'm sure you're very aware, there's this cultural political movement afoot to get us to eat less meat, right? It's bad for the environment. It's bad for us. It's going to give you a heart attack. And there's, it just seems like there's all this propaganda, this anti-meat propaganda. It's almost like people don't want us to be healthy and thriving. In your opinion, if we start to remove meat, what are people going to replace that very nutrient-dense food with? And because I don't understand if we're taking, say, beef off the table here, which is one of the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet, what is the expectation that nutrition experts are wanting us to backfill that with? And what are we actually going to eat? My worry is we're already getting sicker and fatter every single year, despite the amount of money we're spending on medical. What happens when we eat less meat?
Well, we don't have to speculate. We know what happens. I mean, you know, there's a recent study came out 2022 looking at that. People, the more plant-based you go, the more processed food you eat. I mean, that's right. Just clearly what happens. And so, I mean, we saw that when we tried to remove butter from the menu. We started eating more margarine, which is, sure, you know, quite honestly, a bunch of garbage. So yeah, I mean, the reality of the situation, you know, and I know there's vegans out there who are eating lentils and chickpeas and things like that. That's not the reality. The reality is, when you remove meat from the menu, you just replace that energy void with more processed garbage. And conveniently, it tends to be very profitable processed garbage. And so there is a very big financial incentive. I mean, the worldwide meat industry is large. I mean, we're looking at over $1 trillion a year. And so if you can pick off, you know, Meatless Monday, you know, one out of 7 days, that's 14% of that market, you're looking into the hundreds of billions of dollars. And so there's a huge incentive to try to, you know, sort of grab some of that market share. So I think that's mostly what we're seeing there. It's not about health. It's not about saving the planet. It's all about profit. And, oh, by the way, now we're going to have more sick people that also need more medications, right. And that's profitable, right, too. So it's largely driven by profit more than anything else. Anybody that tries to put an altruistic spin on that it's basically a smokescreen. It's really, hey, we want to make, I mean, and that's what every business does. I mean, every business on the planet is there to make as much money as possible for their shareholders. It's same, doesn't matter, sure, if it's a pharmaceutical company or a food company. That is really what this is about.
Okay, so that leads me to this question then. Is there a conspiracy here? Because I wrestle with this all the time. It seems like, especially in our age group, right? 50s, 60s, 70s, we're cash cows. If we are sick, fat, unhealthy, metabolically sick and unhealthy, then, and we're buying into, say, government's advice on what we should eat, which is grain-based processed crap, which we've just discussed, which is going to keep us in that state. And then, of course, pharma's shareholders are getting rich by prescribing us meds to alleviate symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. Is this just the financial reality that we live in, or is there actually a conspiracy afoot? Is there some sort of group of evil, this evil cabal of people that are kind of plotting our sick demise here?
Yeah. I mean, is there like a depopulation agenda?
There's crazy stuff out there right now, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how credible that is, to be honest. I mean, I do think there's a lot of people that want to make money off this. I think there are people that sincerely believe that, you know, like vegans, they seriously believe that eating animals is awful and evil, and we should do everything in our power to possibly do it. You know, we've got guys like Cory Booker on the Senator Cory Booker on the farm, you know, working on the farm bill. So there are people in power that genuinely believe that we should eliminate meat or reduce it or whatever. And I think that's clearly happening. So I don't know if you want to call it a conspiracy, but there are people that are motivated by that. And I think, you know, we see stuff like Bill Gates is buying up all the farmland and Bill Gates is promoting fake meat. And so he does. Yeah. He's got a financial incentive in some of this stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's some people that would like to see You know, and there are megalomaniacs, and there are people that are truly evil in the world. I mean that's been going on since the dawn of time. Often they're corrupted by greed, I think. So I mean, there's some of that, but I think the main realities are, I mean, I honestly think it's mostly a financial thing rather than a desire for power or control or depopulation. I think it's mostly just how can I make more money, and you know, and I don't care about the rest of the people. I mean, that's been going on for since society has started. We have people that want to take advantage of other people and thrive on them.
And it's unfortunate because nutritional science, just human biology, it can be vastly complex. And so for just the average layperson to understand what they should eat, it should be a very simple thing, right? We're a biological animal, yet it's this vastly complex thing, right? And we get inundated with all this conflicting information. New study shows this, new study shows that, new study shows this. And it's really hard for the average person who just wants to lose some weight and be healthy, right, to know what to eat. And so I find the simplicity of carnivore, along with just the very radical testimonies of people changing their health to be very interesting, to say the least. But I think I have to switch this conversation over to the questions that people probably have in their mind. They're like, okay, I didn't realize carnivore was really this big of a thing. I didn't realize people were maybe getting this healthy from it. Number one question, I'm sure you get asked this all the time, what about cholesterol? Because cholesterol, of course, is clogging up our hearts, giving us heart attacks, and that comes from red meat, if I'm not mistaken. That's mostly what you're eating. Is that right?
Well, it's certainly mostly what I'm eating. Now, I mean, I think there's a difference between the fact that saturated fat can contribute to higher cholesterol and the fact that red meat causes heart disease. I don't think that you can make that assumption, because there's a lot of intermediate steps in between there, because red meat has a lot of mitigating factors as well. I mean, there's all kinds of nutrients in red meat that are cardio-beneficial, you know, carnitine, choline, carnosine, things like that. So it's, you know, there was a nice study in the Journal of American College of Cardiology saying that, you know, saturated fat in the form of whole foods, meat, eggs, dairy, things like that, are not associated with heart disease. But saturated fat in general, and you remember, where do Americans get our saturated fat from? Well, only about 3% of it comes from actual whole cuts of meat. You know, the rest of it's coming from frozen desserts and highly processed foods and pizzas and lasagnas and all these things that, yes, they have saturated fat in there, but they have refined carbohydrates and all these other things. So really, you know, that's, I think, an important point. Also, the different types of saturated fat. I mean, saturated fat is just not one thing. I mean, it's capric acid, caproic acid, caprylic acid, myristic acid, lauric acid, oleic acid, palmitic acid, stearic acid. Which one? Because they, you know, each of these have different profiles in there. And some saturated fats are beneficial, and some of them tend to be, I think myristic acid is considered the one that's the most problematic, which is not found in meat, by the way, or not to any significant degree. So, you know, we also are now seeing that, you know, serum cholesterol, certainly while it has an association with cardiovascular disease, that's undeniable. But again, in which population? Which population are you talking about? You're talking about the average person eating a standard mixed diet? Okay, yeah, maybe in that case you should be lower cholesterol. What about a person who eats a clean, whole food, you know, meat-based diet that's otherwise metabolically healthy? Are those people at the same risk? And, you know, I think there's evidence that's starting to suggest that no, they're not. And so I think we have to really figure out there's some nuance here. You know, I mean, for instance, I mean, even the variability of cholesterol. I mean, I did a little kind of experiment the other day. I've got a home cholesterol monitor where I can monitor my own cholesterol. And on Monday morning, it was 156 total cholesterol. Totally fine. No one would say anything negative about that. That's well within the realm. And they like it below 200 and sometimes 190. So I'm well below that. 18 hours later, it was 346. So it went up almost 200 points in under 18 hours. And so now, all of a sudden, now it'd be like, oh my God, you're going to have a heart attack. Let's get the cath lab open, put you on a statin for the rest of your life. And these two labs are less than 24 hours apart. So I think there's a lot even though we've been studying cholesterol since the early part of the 20th century, you know, over 100 years, we still don't know it all. We don't know all these things. And so the data that's emerging, you know, Matt Budoff's study out of UCLA just finished. I mean, we'll hopefully have the data on that, the final data on that later this summer. probably, and again, I'm going to say probably because I haven't seen the results. I mean, I've seen the preliminary data, which would suggest this, that if you are metabolically healthy and you have high LDL cholesterol, it may not be the issue. It may not be the issue. So I think that that science is emerging. And those people that are out there that are like, this is settled, we know it, there's no reason to ask a question, I think that's unscientific in my view. Because most of the data we have on heart disease is on unhealthy people, people that develop heart disease. What about the people that are healthy that don't develop heart disease? Who are those people? We haven't really fully elucidated that yet. And so I think this is where we're starting to get to that point. People are asking the question, but it's expensive. Nobody wants to pay for these studies. I mean, the guys, I mean, thank goodness, you know, Dave has been, I mean, this is basically crowdfunding effort to get this information out, because drug companies don't want this information. Right. They don't want there's people that don't really care about this stuff, and they don't want anything to interfere with their cash cow. You know, hey, I mean, just take a lab test. I mean, you know, like I mentioned, if I could take a lab test on two separate days and one would indicate I need to be on a drug the rest of my life, right? And that's how those decisions are often made. You go to the doctor one time, your LDL cholesterol is high. Oh, we're going to put you on a drug for the rest of your life. No questions asked. And that's the end. And that's it. And these people may be on drugs for 30, 40 years, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy. And that's very interesting, that because a lot of us think of our cholesterol as the static thing, right? And I'm actually seeing folks that come through our coaching practice. Obviously we're asking them the meds that are on, and we see the stat and we say, oh, okay, well, what's your cholesterol? Well, actually, I have a normal cholesterol. My doctor put me on it preventatively. So we've seen that several times now, where there are doctors out there prescribing their patients statins preventatively in other words, to keep them from, it's a crazy, crazy world out there. All right. So going down the list here, that's cholesterol, obviously a more nuanced conversation. What about fiber? Because that's probably the next thing that somebody's going to say, okay, if you're eating all this meat, where are you getting your fiber?
Well, you're not. I mean, you know, fiber is not required. Fiber is not essential. I mean, I literally have had essentially no fiber in 8 years. I'm breaking world records, man. I'm not sick, right? I mean, you know, fiber is, you know, Dennis Burkitt back in the 1930s visited Uganda, I believe, and looked at the fact that these African populations didn't have some of the diseases that we're seeing in Europe at the time, which was, you know, and he concluded they were eating more fiber than everybody else, and therefore fiber was a magical ingredient. And what he didn't really sort of pay attention to was they weren't eating sugar, and they weren't eating all this other crap either. And so that might have been the case. But I mean, the purported benefits of fiber, and there are many, and there's a lot of studies, again, that show that higher fiber diets are associated with less disease. And I think really, it's really a marker of diet quality. You know, like I said, if you're eating a fiber-rich diet, more often than not, you're eating fruits and vegetables and less cookies and cakes and, you know, ice creams and things like that. So I think it's just, again, a marker of disease. One of the biggest things people talk about these days is how fiber impacts the microbiome. You know, we have this gut microbiome, mostly our colon, where fiber is then fermented, and we elucidate these short-chain fatty acids, which have a protective effect on the colonocytes or the enterocytes on the cells. And that's all good and well, but you can get the same exact benefits from protein metabolism. You can get the same benefits from, you know, a lower carbohydrate state where you're endogenously producing all these ketones like beta hydroxybutyrate, which is almost the same thing as butyric acid. There's only one hydroxyl molecule different, and it's a very easily reversible reaction. So Tommy Wood and Lucy Mayling wrote a nice paper in 2021 looking at the metabolic flexibility of the gut that shows that, hey, you can challenge it with fiber, you can challenge it with you know, kind of meat, and you get basically the same beneficial results from that. So in my view, fiber is non-essential. It's conditionally beneficial. If you're on a standard American junk food diet, yeah, eat more fiber. It's probably going to help you. If you're not eating the standard American junk, then, you know, in fact, I see a lot of people where removing fiber from their diet is the best thing they can do for their gut. You know, they have chronic IBS, inflammatory bowel disease, gastroesophageal reflux disease. Taking all the fiber out often helps those people because it prevents all that fermentation, that gas being formed, which can be uncomfortable, you know, can lead to reflux, lead to, you know, obviously chronic bloating and irritation. So fiber, I think, is one of those things where, you know, it's clearly not essential for life, and it's conditionally beneficial for some folks, but at the same time, it is potentially problematic for others.
So that's interesting. Because you're exactly right. When I hear you say, hey, fiber could be problematic, take it out, I suppose there's two ways to do that, right? If I eat low fiber but still standard American diet, I'm just replacing probably, you know, plants, basically whole plants. Yeah, I mean,
don't replace it with refined sugar and stuff like that.
Exactly.
That's not going to help.
Yeah,
right?
Seed oils, etc. No. Okay. All right. So since we set this podcast recording on the calendar, I've been walking around telling my wife, I'm going carnivore. This is it. I'm doing it. I'm eating all meat. And she's horrified. She goes, no. What about, because she's a vegetable lover. She honestly, her favorite foods are vegetables, which to me is just unfathomable. I don't particularly like them. I eat them because I have to. What do you say to somebody who says, well, what about all the phytonutrients and you're missing out in fruits and vegetables? I don't think carnivores eat plants, right? So how do you answer that?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, that's true. We don't eat plants or very little. Maybe some people have some seasonings and things like that. But interestingly, great work, Stefan Van Vliet, you know, out of Duke University, well, formerly Duke, now he's at Utah State. Paper in, I think, 2021, meat has a ton of phytonutrients in it, believe it or not. Beef has, particularly if you see a diverse forage beef, they have polyphenols, they have tannins, they have a whole host of phytonutrients, and they're probably more bioavailable. In fact, they are more bioavailable than we can get from plants, because a cow has the ability to eat a lot of plants that we can't. I mean, we can't eat grass, we can't eat the weeds and all the stuff that they're eating. So they have a rich, diverse diet of these various plant compounds, which get incorporated into the animal tissue, by the way. So by consuming meat, you're getting many of these quote unquote healthy phytonutrients, you know? So yeah, you're getting that stuff anyway. You know, the plant's eating, the cow's digesting it and assimilating it for you. So you're not going to necessarily miss out on that stuff. This is a little known fact, because most people think of protein, meat as protein, a little bit of fat and a few vitamins and minerals, but there are literally something like 70,000 unique nutritional compounds found in beef itself. You know, not to mention the other animals that eat different foods as well. So you are going to get a lot of those quote unquote healthy, whatever you want to say, polyphenols or tannins or, you know, things of that nature.
All right, sold. Tell my wife that the cow eats a salad for me. All right, Sean, who should consider a carnivore diet? Who's a good candidate?
Well, you know, obviously people that are sick. I mean, I think this is, and this is a lot of people in the U.S. I mean, we have, you know, 38 million. We've got 50% of the population is pre-diabetic, 38 mm-hmm. million diabetics. We have 22 to 50 million autoimmune patients. We have, 25% to a third of the people that are on some kind of mental health issue. Any and all those people could potentially benefit from this. And I tend to look at it not necessarily as I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. I look at it as a therapeutic tool. Do it for 3 months, do it for 6 months, see where you get, and then figure out what you can tolerate long term. I'm not here. This isn't religious dogma for me. This isn't like, oh, you got to do it for the rest of your life and it's the only way to get healthy. I've never said that. I won't say that. But I will say it is a very effective tool. And I'll just segue into what we do as a company, Rivero. And we just launched recently, just our first patients are going through. We're licensed in all 50 states. We're already pulling people off medications. And so, which is really cool. That's the whole purpose here. We have too many people that are chronically medicated for conditions that could be basically taken care of and reversed with proper nutrition and lifestyle. So I think, you know, people with food addiction, my gosh, you know, you think about it. How do you treat alcoholism? How do you not treat alcoholism? Well, you don't tell people, hey, just have a couple drinks on a weekend. That's not going to cure your alcoholism. So a lot of these people that are addicted to this ultra processed garbage that we call food, and estimates are about 14% of the population suffers from that, would be good candidates for this. I mean, again, there are many ways to lose weight. There are many ways to get healthy. Carnivore is not the only way. But having said that, it's very simple. It is often dramatically effective. It is, I think, uniquely, you know, when it comes to that food addiction standpoint, it uniquely deals with these cravings that people have, because a lot of people go on a diet and they're miserable. They're hungry. They're starving. You know, they're constantly thinking about food. This, in many cases, sort of makes that not an issue for people. So I think it can be very, very beneficial. And it's instructive just to learn about your body. You know, I mean, if you can get over the fact that red meat is not killing you, and I honestly don't think it is. I think it's really helping people. And you get to feel how it feels. Maybe a lot of people, for the first time in their life, they actually feel what it means to be actually healthy. I mean, you know, a lot of people have this chronic low-level gut irritation or the chronic mood depression or aches and pains. You know, you talk about 50s and 60-year-olds as your podcast audiences. I'm getting close to 60, and I'm able to do things like I did in my 30s right now, and without the aches and pains that often accompany that stuff. So it's, if nothing else, it's instructive to do. You know, my suggestion is try for 3 months, because I think that's how long it may take you, a month or two to adapt to it. So I think 3 months is a good trial period to see what it does for you. And if nothing else, you'll learn something. You know, worst case scenario, you'll eat a bunch of steaks for a couple months, you know, okay, big deal. I mean, most guys in particular are pretty happy with that. You know, there's some women who are kind of, a lot of women are really particularly fearful of red meat for some reason. I think we've brainwashed them into believing that they need to eat salad all day. And maybe they get if they're lucky, they can have a small strip of, you know, boneless, skinless chicken breast on top of that. And that is, you know, unfortunate. But yeah, I mean, one thing I would say, if you are particularly sick and you're on a bunch of medications, there is some caution that needs to be exercised here. Because, you know, I mean, if you're on diabetic meds, you know, if you're on antihypertensive meds for blood pressure, going to a very low carbohydrate diet may cause issues. You know, your blood pressure may drop too low, your glucose may drop too low, and you gotta taper those meds off. And so that's why having some sort of health oversight like our company Rivero does to help you bring that down safely, because there are people that, you know, the transition is maybe something that needs to be done a little more slowly and monitored and supervised.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Cause that was the next thing I was going to ask you, or who are the, what population is this a contradiction for? It doesn't sound like it, or contraindicated for it. It doesn't sound like somebody who's, you know, on meds or sick is a contraindication. In fact, those people should, but they need to be aware if you're taking, for example, blood pressure medicine, and then you go and, you know, do lifestyle modification that's automatically drops your blood pressure, plus you have medicine in you doing the same thing. Some caution there. But what about populations, young people? We often hear pregnant and nursing mothers. Mm-hmm. Are there people that shouldn't consider this, or do you consider this a safe diet?
Well, I think it's generally safe across the board for just about everyone. I mean, there's a few weird genetic orders where they have, you know, difficulties with certain protein metabolism but we're talking, you know, one in several million people. It's pretty, but I mean, the general population, age, sex doesn't really matter that much. I mean, I think it's, the real question is it necessary? I mean, do you need to do this? And I think for most people, or many people, the answer is probably you don't need to do it. I think there are clearly younger people doing this. I've had teenagers do it that get really good results with it. I think, you know, the earlier you learn about your body and learn what's affecting you, the more likely you are to avoid a lot of issues. So it might just be instructive just to say, hey, how do things like dairy and, you know, gluten and, you know, for certain plant compounds affect me? And I can get a good look at that and know how I can maybe, you know, if I care about that. I mean, you know, the reality is most people don't care what they eat. They care in the sense that what does it cost and how does it taste? I mean, that's where most people make their decisions on food. And that's unfortunate, because the food we have to choose from these days is, you know, I think somebody once called this recreational drugs, the ultra processed food that's out there. And I think that's really a really good way to look at that. These are all recreational drugs, and they have some potential negative consequences.
They sure do. Yeah. Hey, Sean, are you okay for time? I see we're coming up on the top of the hour.
I have about 2 minutes, and then I have to go to another meeting.
You got
to
wrap this up. All right. Yeah. Thanks. All right. Well, Sean, as we're wrapping up here, let's just very quickly, what do carnivores eat? Is it just animal products? Is there?
Yeah.
How does get started? You're carnivore curious?
I mean, there's obviously tons of websites and resources. Carnivore.diet, sure, which is one of mine, is good. Obviously, my book is a pretty thorough description of it. And I think it holds up quite well. I mean, it's a lot of meat. I mean, most people eat a lot of red meat. I mean, that just tends to be more satiating I think there's some evolutionary reasons why that may be so. But meat, eggs, you know, seafood, you know, some people do some dairy. It just depends. Some people don't tolerate it as well. But I mean, that's really the crux of the diet. I mean, it's basically eat enough to your full. How much do you eat? Eat enough so you don't want a cupcake or whatever the problem. Mm-hmm. That's what I tell people to start. Just eat enough so you don't have the cravings as much, so that you can deal with that. And then, you know, later you're going to tailor things depending on how you're doing. I mean, you have to be careful of it to make sure you stay hydrated, because low carb diets in general tend to lead to a loss of sodium and water. And you just need to make sure you're refilling that so you don't get lightheaded or things like that. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, in a 1 minute answer, that's how you do it. I mean, obviously there's people with different situate gallbladder, no gallbladder, gastric sleeve bypass or not, you know, certain deficiencies. Organ meats are one of those things that's optional in my view. You don't need to take them. Some people feel like they get a little better with them, but in my view, over time, it doesn't seem to be something that's necessary. So, I mean, you know, you can literally live on just beef, salt, and water indefinitely, in my view. I've done that for years at a time. You know, certainly I go months at a time all the time. So those are options, you know, but beyond that, I think it's just some, you know, drinking water is fine. I mean, every animal on the planet outside of humans drinks water. So, I mean, clearly that's beneficial. Some people include a little coffee or tea in there. I mean, alcohol is not a health food. So again, just like anything else, at best, it should be moderated or eliminated if possible. Yeah, but that's, you know, I mean, that's mostly what it is. It's quite simple.
It's quite simple. And I think that's part of the beauty of it. All right, John, as we're wrapping up here, then tell people, how can they connect with you? Where do you want to send them?
Well, I mean, if you're looking for health benefits, you know, to do that, look at Rivero.com. We are accepting patients on our waiting list right now. We have some 8,000 people on the waiting list. We're slowly adding those back in. So the quicker you get on, the quicker you can get benefits from that. Carnivore.diet is where I'm going there right now after this meeting to spend time with the community. I have several social media channels. My Instagram is Sean, Shawn Baker, Baker, 1967. I'm on X, formerly Twitter, at SBakerMD. I've got a YouTube channel, Sean Baker MD. So that's where you can find me.
All right, folks, I will put all of that information into the show notes. If you guys aren't following Sean on Instagram, get on there. He is a fantastic follow there. That's how I first found you. The book is called The Carnivore Diet, another great resource. I'll put all the YouTube and all the other socials in the show notes. You guys can find that there. Sean, I want to thank you so much for taking the time, coming on the show, and sharing your, not just your wisdom and your knowledge and your information with us on carnivore, but also your passion for this. I love the work you guys are doing, and just encourage you to keep up the great work and getting the message out there for healthy aging.
All right. Appreciate it, Kevin. Got to run, man. Thanks.
All right, man. Thank you. Take care. Okay, that's our show for today, folks. If you've enjoyed this podcast, I want to let you know that we have other free resources over at silveredgefree.com. There, you'll find our free guides with our top tips on nutrition, exercise, and healthy lifestyle to assist you in your weight loss and fitness journey. So feel free to head over there and download anything that looks useful to you. I'll put links to everything we talked about in the show notes, and you folks can find those over at silveredgefitness.com/276. As we wrap up our time together today, you can show your support for this show in two important ways. The first is to tell a friend about this podcast and encourage them to give it a listen. The second is for you YouTube folks to click the like and subscribe buttons, and for you podcast folks to please give this podcast a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening, and be sure to subscribe and follow so you don't miss any future episodes. I really appreciate you spending your time with me today, and until next time, stay strong.